Matthew chapter 9. Looking at times when the New Testament quotes the Old Testament. And particularly what we're going through right now is the red letter section. We're looking when Jesus, personally, when he was on the earth, when he quoted the Old Testament. And so the one that we want to pick up here, we've already gone through all the stuff in Matthew 5 where he quoted a lot. The next place here is in Matthew chapter 9. And that's when he's getting Matthew. So let's pick it up in verse 9. It says, "And as Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax office, and he said to him, 'Follow me.' And he rose and followed him. And it happened that as he was reclining at the table in the house, behold, many tax gatherers and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, 'Why is your teacher eating with the tax gatherers and sinners?' But when he heard this, he said, 'It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means: I desire compassion and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners.'" Okay, now let's get this whole calling of Matthew in its context. Sometimes you see this here and you go, "Oh, this is the first time he's ever saw Matthew. He just somehow was instantly attracted to Matthew and said, 'Hey, come follow me.'" But if you flip over to Acts chapter 1, and we'll start from verse 21. It's when Peter, in reference to some Old Testament quotes, which we'll deal with at a future time, makes the connection that, hey, we need to get somebody to take Judas's place here. So in verse 21, it says, "It is therefore necessary that of the men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning with the immersion of John until the day that he was taken up from us, one of these should become a witness with us of his resurrection." And so then they put forward the two men who met those qualifications: Joseph, called Barsabbas, who was also called Justice, and Matthias. And then they prayed that Jesus would choose the one. They cast lots. Jesus made the choice, and they had their 12th apostle. Okay, now, Powder, you can't be one of the 12. They're already done. Okay, so But what I want us to notice is the requirement for the one who would take Judas's place was that he had to be with them. It says he had to have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning with the immersion of John until the day that he was taken up. Okay, so the ones that they're going to choose had to have been there, had to have accompanied us from the time that Jesus was immersed by John, beginning with the immersion of John. So when you're looking at the apostles, sometimes you get a look at Jesus calling his apostles, and it used to kind of weird me out, for lack of a better way to put it, that Jesus somehow, you know, he's just walking along the Sea of Galilee, sees these guys, and says, "Hey, come follow me," and they just drop everything. I'm just going, wow. He must have had some kind of presence or something. You know, what was it? Well, this wasn't their first contact with him. I mean, you actually go back and trace things through. They had been with him for a while. They had been following him at various times, listening to him prior to this. It's just there that what you have there is Jesus' actual calling, saying, "Hey, it's now time, you know, it's time to ramp things up. You know, you've to this point, you've seen me as a good teacher. You've seen me as a guy who has been hanging around Capernaum here. But he said, he's going, now it's time. We're going full time on the road, getting out of here and going to really stir things up a bit." And so he's specifically choosing some of these guys and letting them know. OK, so when you have him talking to Matthew, then it's not the first time he's ever seen Matthew. It's not that Matthew's sitting in the tax booth and Jesus has never seen this guy before and then suddenly goes, oh, I think he'll be good. Matthew would have had to have been there at Jesus' immersion, which means that Matthew would have originally been one of John's, at least to an extent, one of John's disciples. He would have listened to the preaching of John. He would have known what had been said. So he would have known who Jesus was. Odds are, by this point in time, by the time you get to Matthew chapter 9, which we can flip back there now, but by the time you get to Matthew chapter 9, there's already been some stuff going on. Matthew's been around. He knows what's going on. And so this is just Jesus making things a little bit on the official side and letting Matthew know, hey, I really want you with me. Yeah, you're one of those loyal guys. I want you coming with me. You know, and you have those things. I mean, that's what you see Jesus doing with all the apostles. He's doing, I mean, he does it with the ones by the sea. When he gets Peter and James and Andrew and John, not in that order, but when he gets those four, it's the same kind of thing. So when they're dropping their nets, these other apostles are dropping their nets and going with them. He's already been in their boat. He's already been with them. They've already heard him teach and preach. It's not a new thing. This is not some miraculous, mystic kind of deal here. This is, they have been convinced. They know who he is. And Jesus is saying, it's time. Let's get on the road and let's get this thing moving. Now, that doesn't negate the commitment that's being made by these guys. It's just not, it takes the mysticism out of it a bit and puts it in the realm of knowledge. They knew what they were doing. Okay, so back to Matthew. Matthew, then Jesus comes and he says, follow me. He arose, he followed him, left his tax stuff. And if you look in Luke's account, it actually, it says, verse 10, it says it happened that he was reclining at the table in the house. Luke actually tells us that after this, Matthew throws a big party at his house. So this is actually taking place at Matthew's house and with all of Matthew's acquaintances. Matthew's pretty much going, hey, if we're going to ramp this thing up, I'm going to get everybody I know involved in it. And so he's bringing in all the tax gatherers, anybody he knows. And, you know, as a tax gatherer, he would have lots of interesting connections, lots of contacts, particularly with those that would be called tax gatherers and sinners. So they're there in the house. They're dining with Jesus at Matthew's house. And the Pharisees said they saw this and they said to his disciples, why is your teacher eating with the tax gatherers and sinners? You know, why is he defiling himself in such a way? Why is he associating with such low life? Well, verse 12 says, when he heard this, he said, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. Now, a lot of times people, in reference to the church, you know, sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I don't like that church. Got a lot of hypocrites in it. Or you got a lot of bad people, a lot of sinners, you know, people who are sinners and stuff. Wasn't it Jesus who said, it's not the healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick? See, doesn't it seem like the church is the place where you would find such people? You ought to find such people. You know, a lot of times people get concerned about the outward appearance of the church. You know, that somehow we got to have this, we got to look good to the community. You know, and so sometimes people want to even take the approach that we need to get it out in the community. You know, let's get in the parades and let's get in the, you know, let's do the Sweet Pea Festival, you know, get our little float going down there, the Christchurch floats, and, you know, and let's kind of get out there and get a cosmetically good-looking appearance. That's not what the church is all about. See, Jesus pretty much describes the church as a hospital where it's not those who are healthy who need the physician, the great physician, Jesus, but those who are sick. You know, so the church should look like a hospital. Now, You don't go to the hospital to expect to see all kinds of well people. I mean, generally speaking, you go to the hospital and you expect to see sickness. I mean, at least among the patients. Now, you kind of hope that the people who are working there are well, you know, but you expect to see sick people. Now, you expect to see sick people who are getting better. That's the idea. You go to the hospital to get better. It doesn't always happen that way, I know. Quite often, I guess, sometimes the hospital tends to be the place where people pick up even more diseases. God forbid that the church would be that way, though. But it does happen sometimes. That was a side note. Okay, so Jesus says, hey, you shouldn't be expecting to see everybody healthy. Now, those who are healthy in the hospital, doctors, nurses, people who are helping and getting everybody else healthy. See, in the church, we actually ought to have some healthy people. Doesn't mean everybody has to be sick and filled with sin and, you know, have all kinds of sins that they're continually working on. That's not the intention. The idea is you eventually get healthy and then you're helping everybody else. So you become a doctor or a nurse or something to that effect. An intern. Is that what we're interns. Jesus is the doctor. We get to be the interns. Might even need a few candy stripers. Okay. Jesus' response to them. Says, it's not the healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. Go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice. For I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, we'll go back and look at this, where he's quoting this from, because we want to pick up some things from there. But let's kind of cover this point a little bit. He says, go and learn what this means. Got something for you here to learn. He's talking to the Pharisees. They should already know this. But he says, go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Doesn't that give us a little guidance as well when we're talking about the church? I desire compassion. Do you think that's maybe what God's looking for from us too? Toward other people? And perhaps toward their struggles with sin? Is a little compassion? And not a nailing them to the wall? Now, let's go back. Hosea 6:6. This is where Jesus is actually quoting this from. So he did well. He studied his Hosea. Could probably even find it very quickly. Without even having the chapter and verse markings. Hosea 6:6. It says, for I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Okay, now, do you notice a difference between this and what Jesus said? Where's the difference coming in? Anybody?
Desire
compassion. And Hosea says loyalty. Maybe Jesus misquoted, huh? Needs to work on his memory work a little bit more. Maybe he just did the once a week thing like Mr. Edgar was saying. You know, I don't think so. But that is the difference. I delight in loyalty here. It says I delight in loyalty. Jesus delight in compassion rather than sacrifice. So why the difference? Let you ponder for a moment. Loyalty. Just a interesting little note there. The word there, I'll even give you your Hebrew for the day. Are we ready for your Hebrew for the day? The word there that's translated loyalty is kesed. I don't know if that's properly spoken Hebrew. I didn't study Hebrew. I did Greek, not Hebrew. So kesed. Very, very common word. Used throughout the Old Testament. Most often translated mercy, kindness, goodness, loving kindness. There's like 250 times it's used almost. Technically 247, but used over and over again. And almost every time it's translated as loving kindness. It's translated most often as kindness. Lots of times as mercy, goodness. Only six times as loyalty. See, did Jesus misquote? No, he didn't. He apparently knew his Hebrew as well. Probably better than we know our Hebrew. Obviously better. But he knew what the meaning of the word was. You know, so why would the translators at this point choose to use loyalty instead of compassion? Or use loyalty instead of mercy? Well, let's talk about Hosea for a couple minutes. Hosea was a prophet. And I have absolutely no desire to be a prophet. I'm really glad that that day has passed and we don't have to be prophets. I really like preaching. You know, we can say, well, our modern day prophets, our today prophets are those who preach the word because we're speaking God's word, just like the prophets were, which is good. But, you know, God did some special things with prophets that I'm really glad that I don't have to join in on. You know, I'm not really fond of getting sawed in half. That one might happen. I haven't closed the door on that one. You know, that one could happen. There are probably some who already would like to saw me in half. And in the future, I know there will be some who might choose to. So the saw in half thing, I don't know. You know, that was things that other people would do. But, you know, you had interesting things like running around naked. I'm not very fond of that one. You all can be very glad of that. laying down on your side for long periods of time. You know, I'm happy I get there. Yesterday morning I slept in. And about 7 o'clock or so, I had to get up. You know, and I had gone to bed about midnight, so, you know, it was feeling pretty good. But, you know, after a while, laying on the side for very long, I don't know if you guys get into that, you gotta keep rolling over. Can you imagine laying on your side without moving? I'm thinking Ezekiel would have been in some pain after a while with that one. But Hosea's is the one probably that of all of them, I think I could handle some of the other things better than I could handle Hosea's. God said, go and marry a wife of harlotry. For all practical purposes, go marry a prostitute. And so he does. I don't know. Isaiah's thing with his wife probably would have been tough, too, when she died and he wasn't allowed to mourn. That might have been a tough one as well. But anyway, sorry. So back to Hosea. That was a freebie. Back to Hosea. So Hosea takes a wife of harlotry, marries this prostitute, has one child by her. In fact, go back to the first chapter of Hosea. The names of the children mean a lot. His wife's name was Gomer. Not Pyle. Not Gomer Pyle. But his wife's name was Gomer. Says she conceived, bore him a son. This is actually his son. His name was Jezreel. Dealing with the punishment that God is going to bring on the house of Jehu. And then you get down a little bit later, verse 6, it says, then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Notice it doesn't say bore him a daughter. She gave birth to a daughter. The Lord said to him, name her Lo Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel. So, let's see. Lo Ruhamah means, let me find that one real quick. She's not obtained compassion. Okay, my daughter's named Montana. Imagine naming my daughter, you've not obtained compassion. I'm not going to be compassionate toward you. You know, so you can begin to see that either she's not Hosea's, or he's suspecting that she's not his. So not obtained compassion. And then the best one then is the next one. It says, verse 8, when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son, and the Lord said, name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people and I'm not your God. Lo-Ami means not my people. How about naming your kid that? Oh, you're not mine. Okay, so she's engaging in harlotry while married to him. Well, eventually she leaves, and in chapter 3 is where then Hosea goes and gets her and buys her back. You know, and all of that is symbolism of what God was doing for mankind in general and Israel in particular. And also, I mean, it all was for a purpose. God wasn't just being cruel. I just don't think that I'd be interested in that kind of a deal, you know, especially, you know, God saying, hey, this is what I want you to do. But all of this, then God's dealing with the fact that Israel, just like Gomer being married to Hosea, was faithless to him. She didn't remain faithful to him and was going out and prostituting herself. He says Israel's doing the same thing. And that was the whole thing that he's trying to communicate to Israel was, hey, you're going out here and you're going after these other gods. That's adultery. You're breaking the covenant with me. So you're out there, you know, you're committing adultery with these other gods and sinning against me, who is your husband. So when you get to Hosea chapter 6, he's dealing with the unfaithfulness of Israel. And so verse 4, he says, what shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? For your loyalty, by the way, that's the same word, is like a morning cloud and like the dew which goes away early. In other words, hey, your loyalty, your faithfulness to me, you're saying it with your mouth and it's there for a short time. You're faithful to me for a short time, but like kind of like the morning dew, it's there at the very first part of the morning, but then it's gone. And so you're starting out, you're saying it all right, sounds good, but then you're going off and not being faithful to me. So verse 5, he says, therefore, I've hewn them in pieces by the prophets. I've slain them by the words of my mouth. And the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. And that's awesome stuff, but we're not going to go through that. Verse 6, for I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Now, God in this, I mean, if you're pulling it from this context, loyalty does make the most sense. Because what he's dealing with is Israel's loyalty to him. So when the translators are translating it, they're doing a fine job. They're not making a mistake and, oops, they put loyalty in there and it should have been compassion or mercy. They're looking at the context. And in this context, yeah, he is. Loyalty fits. That is an acceptable translation of that. But one of the great things about God is that he knows what he's doing. So even though, I mean, is there another word? And I meant to check this one out, and I'm sure there is. Is there another word that could be used for loyalty? There probably is. I forgot to check it out. That he could have used here? Yeah, probably so. But as Hosea is prophesying this, God knows this is going to be used in Matthew chapter 9. And for what purpose? Go over just for a moment. Go over to Acts chapter 2. Yes. Acts chapter 2, verses 30 and 31. Peter's preaching on the day of Pentecost, and he says, And so because he was a prophet, he's speaking about David there, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants upon his throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, that he was neither abandoned to Hades nor did his flesh suffer decay. Okay, now there are some things in there that later on we're going to go over, or future time we'll go through, because there are lots of quotes there. But what I want us to notice, it says he was a prophet. David was a prophet, and so, verse 31 says, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ. What a prophet does, by definition, is he looks ahead and speaks of what is to come. So when Hosea, the prophet, is speaking this, for I desire loyalty rather than sacrifice, he's looking ahead and he's speaking, but in a sense, and this is something I think Steve Doty's picked out, is that those Old Testament prophets, the original intent of it, in a sense, the original speaking, if you're not limited by time, the original speaking would be like what Jesus was saying. And Hosea is looking ahead and seeing that Jesus is going to say this, and he's putting it in his stuff. With help from God, of course. So God's the one that's given him this stuff, but God's going, okay, I need this here, so let's put it right back here. So when Jesus is quoting this, I mean, yeah, he studied his Hosea, but in a sense, too, it's more than just he studied his Hosea. He knows the real meaning behind it. He knows the real purpose behind it. And that is the emphasis on compassion. Because if you get over to Matthew chapter 9, go back over to Matthew chapter 9. Jesus' focus, he says, when he says, go and learn what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous but sinners. Try using the direct quote from Hosea as it's translated in Hosea and see if it works. But go and learn what this means. I desire loyalty and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous but sinners. Does it work? Doesn't really make sense. What do you mean I desire loyalty? They're complaining about how he's eating with tax gatherers and sinners, and he's telling them it's not the healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. And then he starts speaking about loyalty? Doesn't make sense. This was doing was he had full understanding. Yeah, in the context. And see, this, I guess the point that I'm trying to make, let me see if I can try to make this clearly, is a lot of times people want to say, we got to go back and we got to see how it's used in the Old Testament. Sometimes people get things in reverse. And they say, let's see how it's used in the Old Testament. Let's see how it's context and let's see what it means there. And somehow that's going to be the real meaning. That's not the real meaning. The real meaning is what Jesus is applying to it. Is how Jesus is using it. That's really what it means. And Hosea is borrowing it. So it's kind of the flip of what most people would think. Is that making any sense? Okay. See, the question is not, does the Old Testament explain the New Testament? Or that's not the way it is. It's not that the Old Testament explains the New Testament. The New Testament explains the Old. See, the Old Testament writers, they're writing things, and to them it's a mystery. They didn't even fully did Hosea really fully understand what he was putting there? No. No. I'm sure that Hosea understood it in its context of Israel's faithlessness and lack of loyalty to God, and that God desired them to be loyal to him more than he desired just sacrifices, that he desired them to know him rather than their offerings. I'm sure that Hosea understood that part of it, but did he really understand that what God was looking for was something here that Jesus is pointing out, compassion? See, the one thing lacking in the law is compassion. There's no room in law for compassion and mercy. Law, by its definition, law is there to judge, and that's its purpose. It renders the judgment. If there is any mercy that you get in a courtroom, it's not according to the law. It's according to the mercy of the judge. It's only the judge who can grant any mercy. The law itself grants no mercy. The Pharisees, when Jesus is speaking to them, he's trying to get them to understand that there are things beyond the law. There are things beyond the letter of the law. There are things beyond just looking at where people are outwardly. And instead, looking at them with compassion. He's saying, hey, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. The Pharisees were really good at the sacrifice. They were good. I think last week we looked at Matthew 23 where they even tithed of their dill and their mint and their cumin and all their little spices and stuff. They were really good at all the sacrifice end of things. God says, or Jesus is telling them, hey, God himself said through Hosea, I desire compassion. Legitimate use of it. Yes, Raymond.
From the standpoint of what is spoke about in Matthew chapter 9, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire loyalty and not sacrifice. If you look at what he's referencing there, the need of a physician. You know, and a doctor's job is a pretty dedicated job and requires quite a bit of understanding in this light would be of personal character, spiritual necessity of man, all different kinds of things. And in Galatians chapter 6, he talks about, brethren, even if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. So compassion, gentleness, kindness, you know, God's called us essentially to be spiritual doctors in a land that's wrought with the disease of darkness. And so, but it demands our loyalty.
It does. I agree with you there. I agree that that God does intend for us to be those doctors as well. Not that we bring the healing. In a sense, we're the ones who bring the people to the doctor. Because Jesus is the only one who can really bring the healing. We have, you know, all the resources and we have all the ways to get them there. Maybe we're the ambulance drivers.
Because I go to the Father, greater works will you do.
The greater works are that we are able to bring even more to him. I mean, you don't personally on your own save somebody. He's the one. It's even when you're making disciples, this is one of the things I like from Romans 15. A lot of times people talk about, you know, I've got my disciples, my disciples, my disciples. Well, I don't see anywhere in there where you're supposed to be making your disciples. You're supposed to be making disciples of Christ. And so even in Romans 15, Paul refers to his preaching of the gospel. He's offering up the Gentiles as a sacrifice to God, that they're actually they're disciples of Christ. We are showing people to Christ. He's the one that does the saving. He's the one that does the healing. He's the one that does all of it. But we get to be the ones who are bringing people. So the greater works that we do. Fact was, there couldn't be any healing that went on while Jesus was on earth. Any permanent healing until he ascended to the Father. There was no permanent, you know, forgiveness of sins. There wasn't the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. That all had to. He had to go to the Father first. So in that sense, we do get to do the greater works because we do get to bring people right up to it. And now, ultimately, though, Jesus is the one who's doing it. It's like when you're looking at immersion in Colossians 2:12, it's faith in the working of God. He's the guy that does the work. We're the assistants along the way. Now, if we don't assist people to get there, nobody gets healed. So, but like in this context here, when he's talking about the I desire compassion, he's speaking specifically to the Pharisees. He's nailing them to the wall and saying, hey, you should be able to figure out, you know, you should be looking at these sinners. You should be looking at these tax gatherers, and you should be feeling compassion for them instead of judging them. The law already judged them. Your role should be to show them compassion. Now, go over to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12, Jesus quotes this again. And this time it's not about the tax gatherers and sinners. Matthew chapter 12, we're going to pick it up from verse 1. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath through the grain fields, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, behold, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on a Sabbath. But he said to them, have you not read what David did? When he became hungry, and he and his companions, how he entered the house of God, and they ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. So he answers their whole question about whether these guys, you know, they're eating. And, you know, the whole situation, disciples are going along, they're getting hungry, they're walking through the field. The law permits them. I know to us it sounds strange. You know, we have our laws of private property and all would say you don't go walking through somebody's field and break off some of their grain and start eating it. However, with the Old Testament law, that was still an acceptable practice. As long as you, I think it was, as long as it was only what you could hold in your hands, I think is how it went. But anyway, it was specifically laid out in the law that you could do that. So they're going through and they're eating some of it. They're hungry. And the Pharisees are coming down on them because they said they're breaking the law. They're working. They're harvesting. Now, just on a little side note, I don't think they really understood the law even that well anyway. Because if the law is saying that there are limitations, as you know, if you're just taking it from somebody's property, then, if you're just taking like a handful or whatever, then that's not stealing from them. Then I'm not sure that you could make the application that they're working either by harvesting. But they're saying, hey, these guys are breaking the law. And so Jesus lays it out and says, well, there are some things that are greater than this law. That being Jesus, and pretty much his message to them is, they're following me, they're with me, and they're hungry, they need to eat, and they need to hang with me here. So if they need to do this, I'm cool with it. And if I'm cool with it, what's your problem? But obviously, they're not there yet. They don't really recognize who they're talking to. And so he finishes up, though, in verse 7. But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. Now, I did go back and look at this, and I was really trying to, and I don't think I can prove it, but I can give my opinion in the matter. So I will put this out as my opinion, but I don't think it's a provable one, so I'll just leave it in the realm of my opinion. But I think that these are the same guys that he's talking to. I tried to check it out and see if he was in the exact location, and I haven't been able to. If you can put it together and see if he's in the same place or different places, I'm okay with that too. But I personally kind of like it that these are the same guys. Because in chapter 9, he tells them, go and learn what this means. And in chapter 12, he says, but if you had known what this means. You know, pretty much, hey, I already told you to go figure this one out. What, you didn't do your homework? You know, I told you to go figure this out. You didn't go do it. If you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. Which, by the way, there Jesus just said those guys were innocent. He did say they weren't breaking the law. They weren't doing anything wrong anyway. But he says, if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice. See, in that case, he's not talking about, you know, even in that case where they're thinking that these guys are breaking the law, Jesus is still saying, hey, compassion is greater than sacrifice. It's greater than you're sticking straight to the law and got to have this and apply the law. It's compassion. Now, does that mean that there won't be a judgment day? No. There will be a judgment day. Jesus will judge. He gets to be the judge. And the standard by which we're to be judged, his words, already said it. So we've got the standard there. We've got, there will be a judgment day. But what's our part in the equation? Well, guess what? You're not the judge. You don't get to be the judge. What he's looking for from you is compassion. You know, too many times people will err on the side of law. On the side of, hey, this is what it says and this is what you got to do. I mean, even when you're dealing with people who aren't Christians, which is what Jesus was dealing with. I mean, particularly in dealing with the tax gatherers and sinners case. I mean, you almost have the two, both settings. You've got the tax gatherers and sinners who aren't really his disciples at this point. Back in Matthew 9, they're not really his disciples. They're just interested people. And maybe they've just been invited to a party. Hey, party time. And Jesus is associating with them and says, hey, you need to be compassionate. You know, there is the time where, you know, Ken's learning this very, very well. He's been with me on a good study, a guy that is currently in Israel. He's out checking out Israel for us. So we'll hear about that in July when he gets back. But in that study, you know, Ken will often tell me afterward, he said, you know, I'm learning to keep my mouth shut some. You know, it's tough, isn't it? Sometimes it is. It's flat out tough. You know, I don't know how many times I've been in a study where you just let so many things slide. I don't know if you guys have ever experienced that, where you're teaching somebody, you're working with somebody, and there are just so many things that you let slide. You know, even when I was going to be on the jury, when they were questioning me for the jury a few couple months back, one of the things that the lawyer asked me, he said, okay, is we're going to end up dealing with some profanity in this trial. Is that going to bother you? I said, well, don't particularly like it. Don't use it myself. But I also study with some ex-convicts. It settled it for him. I guess I got stuck on the jury. And yes, I did get to listen to a lot of profanity. No, I didn't enjoy it. But, you know, see, there are lots of things that you let slide. And it's not just the behavior of the people. I mean, sometimes some false ideas that they have. Sometimes you just got to let some things slide until you can deal with it at the right time. That's compassion. I mean, you try to deal with everything. You get to study with somebody and you try to deal with every little issue that comes up. You're going to make it nowhere. And you're going to drive them out the door. I mean, you got to figure out what you're going to let slide and what's going to really be important. And that means compassion. You've got to have compassion for people's souls. You've got to love them and you've got to love their souls. That you're willing to overlook some things. Now, the first setting is Jesus with the tax gatherers and sinners. The second one is Jesus with his disciples. And in a case where these Pharisees were trying to nail these guys down because they thought that these guys were wrong, Jesus said, well, they're not wrong, but I desire compassion. You know, even within the church, you know, to deal with the tax gatherers and sinners, make the application for dealing with people who are out in the world. When he's right here, when he's dealing with the disciples, make the application for right here in the church. there are going to be times where the right way to deal with something is to let things slide and show compassion. And that's tough. Because you kind of, the temptation once you get in this situation is they should know better. That's what the Pharisees were going. These guys should know better. They should know the law. They're claiming to be your disciples. They're claiming to follow you. And they don't know this. They don't know that this is breaking the law. Yeah, maybe sometimes people should know better. But you know what? Sometimes they don't. And sometimes they have other things that are a little bit higher on their list of things they're working on. So, compassion. You know, Rain pointed out the verse in Galatians 6, where you who are spiritual restore such a one in the spirit. If anyone has been caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness. Look into yourself lest you also. Notice it's the spiritual ones who get to do that restoring, and it's in gentleness. And it's a restoration thing. See, generally speaking, the way that we need to deal with one another is with compassion. Go over to Colossians chapter 2, and we'll tie this up at the end here. Sorry, chapter 3. We're going to pick it up in verse 12. After he's already dealt with who we are in Christ and the whole new creation stuff and the transformation process, I mean, it's an excellent section, but you get to verse 12 then. He says, and so as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion. See that? Put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. And then after that, you can put on love. See, in our dealings with one another, it's a whole lot more important to remember that God said, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. To bear with one another, forgive each other. Whoever has a complaint against anyone for any reason, forgive. It's the best way to deal with it. You know, there are those who do have to deal with the problems. They're called you who are spiritual. And they have enough experience that they're going to do it in a spirit of gentleness. Judge. He's called Jesus. And he'll get his chance. But for most of us, most of the time, compassion toward one another should be our modus operandi. That's the way we deal with one another. It's pretty much put yourself in the other person's shoes. Did you ever notice that? When you start trying to see it from the other person's point of view, suddenly the law and exactly how they're wrong fades into not really a major concern. And you become concerned about the person themselves. So, if we have any Pharisees among us who need to hear what Jesus had to say, or if we have been at times, even though we're not a Pharisee, but maybe have behaved as a Pharisee, which would probably be a better way to put it, since I don't think we have any Pharisees, but we might have some who have at times behaved as a Pharisee. So if you have behaved as a Pharisee at any point in time, the words of Jesus ring true. Go and learn what this means. if you had known what this means. I desire compassion and not a sacrifice.